six. So you were just saying that there was no despondency.
No, I can't remember any. If anything, just the reverse. It was a very happy-go-lucky atmosphere, and we used to go down into Lincoln. At least the others had. By this time, I was married, and I had a flat in Lincoln, and I used to meet them. My wife and I, we used to meet the lads in one of the pubs in Lincoln most nights of the week, and it would either sometimes be sergeants, sometimes officers, sometimes a mixture, but they'd all frequent the same pubs, and not only the pilots from Scampton, but also the pilots from Waddington too. That was another aerodrome about the same distance away from Lincoln as Scampton was on the north side.
How did you find your position as a sergeant pilot, in that you were not one of the officers, but you were not quite one of the men either?
I think, in retrospect, that the sergeant pilots were respected by the ground crews. I don't think that there was any ill feeling because they were pilots. I myself, I always got on very, very well with the ground crews. One of the anomalies that I don't know how the Air Ministry get round this, or how official policy gets round it, but one can have an experienced sergeant pilot and have an inexperienced officer as his second pilot. It happened with me on several occasions, actually on operations, when in the aircraft I was the skipper and giving the orders, but as soon as we landed, service protocol then immediately said that I'd got to call him sir, and he was my senior. It was a complete anomaly.
Was it very rigidly adhered to, or was there a good deal of common sense in the way that it's treated?
Now, except for the odd officer who took the regulations to the nth degree. There was a lot of common sense, and I think that I know that the senior officers, when I say senior officers, I mean the squadron commanders and flight commanders that I had experienced with, they looked upon their flying personnel as according to their experience rather than their rank. And the number of times that a sergeant was called upon to do a certain task, whereas possibly an officer wasn't, and that would be an officer with some experience, but not in the CO's opinion, as much experience as flying experience as the sergeant. That happened quite often. It was a very, very funny attitude, and it's gone. I don't know whether it goes on today, but up till then, it had gone on from the First World War.
In those last few months before the war broke out, what kind of training did you do at Scampton?
Very little special training, considering that war was or seemed imminent. There didn't seem very much directive from high up. Very little, in fact. There was still no policy, real policy, as regards whether we should fly by night or by day. We only flew by night eventually because some early losses were so devastating as made it absolutely essential.
So did you do any night flying during those 2 months before the war broke out?
I can't remember it. After war broke out, we certainly did. We did an awful lot, but I can't remember it from May until the 3rd of September. But we may have done.
Did you, in fact, manage to get some flying in every day during that period, for instance?
During the time that I arrived on the squadron, and the 1st of September, I did 25 trips. Sometimes as pilot myself, other times with someone else.
And were these trips specifically designed to practice any particular aspect, like navigation or
bombing? Yes, reconnaissance certainly, photography certainly, and in my particular case, as I was learning to fly Hamdens, quite a few, of course, were type experience.
Did you ever do any exercises with fighters? Going against
not
fighters?
Not until after war broke out. Certainly not in this period of, what is it, about 4 months.
So, in general terms, at the time, did you feel that you were being pushed to the limit in
no,
the training?
No, I don't think there's any doubt about that. We weren't being pushed to the limit at all. Not certainly not what I expected. I expected before I arrived on the squadron that we would be training day and night, because although Chamberlain had got a respite at Munich, I think that everyone knew that war was still inevitable. In fact, I was surprised that it went as long as a year before war actually did break out.
Can you remember how you heard that war had been declared and what your feelings were at that moment?
Yes, sir, I can remember it very well, because I was flying at the time, and it was after I landed that I was told that war had broken out. And I said, oh, it's come at last, because from the 1st of September it was absolutely inevitable. It was just a question of which hour is it going to be, sort of thing.
Well, finally, could you just outline for me the kind of work that you did up until when you were shot down in 1940, and actually describe that final trip for me?
Until I was shot down, for the first part, all through the phony war, we did virtually nothing except some training. But in the February, after Christmas, we went up to Kinloss in Scotland. We went to Kinloss, and our sister squadron 83 Squadron, they went to Lossiemouth, which is a few miles along the coast from Kinloss, on the Moray Firth. And these two aerodromes were chosen specially because they never have fog. They lie in the Gulf Stream and they never have fog. And we were sent up there specifically to go looking for German submarines. We never found a submarine. Our sister squadron found one, bombed it, and luckily missed because it happened to be a Royal Naval submarine. Otherwise, things were fairly quiet. Up there, we did several long and very boring sweeps over the North Sea, just flying over the Grey Sea, but seeing nothing. However, after the invasion of Norway, from thence onwards, it was very, very busy. And up to this time, too, we'd been doing a lot of night flying to prepare everyone for what was ahead, and all the flying after that, all the operational flying, that is, was done at night. We did the Hamdens did a lot of flying, laying mines off the coast of Norway in the Norwegian fjords, along the Kiel Canal. These were arduous operations because one had to come down to 300 feet to put the mine down. Not only for accuracy, but you had to come down to that level because if it was dropped too high, the mine would disintegrate. But at 300 feet, it would hit the water and settle safely on the bottom of the canal or the sea or wherever it was. They were magnetic mines, of course, and from my subsequent reading, they were very successful, and a lot of German shipping was sunk. We did a lot of trips. I did many with Flight Lieutenant Leroyd, and we came back shut up on many occasions, but we got back. We, after about 17 trips with him, I'd been appointed as a captain, and I did then trips on my own. I did, I think it was 14 altogether, yes, because I was on my 31st trip when I got shot down. I did some mining trips and some bombing trips. The place where I met my Waterloo was over the Ruhr in Germany, although I had been to the Leuna oil works near Leipzig. It was a long trip, and it was quite a straightforward bombing trip, and as far as I know, a successful one. But on the way back, poor meteorological information meant that we were blown badly off course over the Ruhr. Our track should have taken us well clear of the Ruhr, where I was caught in very, very heavy Akak barrages. One engine was hit and seized up solid, and I soldiered on one engine. Soldiered on until I reached the Dutch coast, a distance of some 100 miles, I think it is. But then that engine started to run rough, and I saw that it was losing oil pressure rapidly, so I knew then that there was no hope, because I still had 70 miles of the Channel North Sea to cross. So, having asked ascertained from the navigator that we were overland, he says yes, he could see the coast. I then gave the orders to bail out, and all members of the crew bailed out and landed safely.
Thank you very much indeed.